Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, something interesting started to occur. The Democrats started listening to their base. Yeah, after a weekend in which demonstrations erupted at major airports across the country in protest of President Donald Trump's Muslim travel ban, Democrats in Washington have suddenly found some steel, standing with their supporters in the street and withdrawing a more readily offered rubber stamp in the Senate confirmation hearings. Can they possibly keep this up? Meanwhile, we need to talk about that executive order itself. Talk about a Friday news dump. The Trump White House's directives, which initially barred refugees, travelers, and legal permanent residents alike from entering or re-entering the country, caused disorder and chaos across the country, all of which the Trump administration is pretending to have not noticed. We're going to break down what we know and what might come next. And finally, the new president had the opportunity this week to dip his toe in the fetid pond left behind by his predecessor, the ongoing conflict in Yemen, which played host to Donald Trump's first command decision as the commander-in-chief. It's an open question how Trump will deal with this mess that Obama left behind, but this week gave us some indication about the shape that Donald Trump's foreign policy might take. Is it going to be good? Well, I would stick around to hear for myself if I were you, but spoiler alert, no. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Elise Foley. And here's what happened first. Hey, America, it's podcast time. Once again, welcome to another edition of So That Happened, our weekly forage in the garbage trench that is American politics. Glad to have you here. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post, and I'm joined, as always, by esteemed colleagues, fellow member of the London Barrantes Appreciation Society, Zach Carter.
Hi, everyone.
And also with us today, we have someone who's just done a terrific job, and more people are recognizing him, Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
What's up?
Alive.
We're still alive, man. All of you out there, if you're hearing this, you're still alive too. Probably, maybe you're not. But last week we were talking about, well, many sundry things, but we also talked about a little bit about the Democratic Party and how they're coming to terms with the new reality that is the Trump administration and whether or not they're keeping pace with a Democratic base that seems ready to rumble, go out in the streets, protest, drop the hammer on policies that look bad. I think, Zach, this time last week, we were kind of feeling like the Democrats were completely 100% blowing it. Over the past few days, I think they've maybe righted the ship a little bit.
I think they've gone from totally blowing it to being sort of confused and stumbling in the right direction. I think there was some when Elizabeth Warren, who is sort of the most the Democratic leader who is most willing to be critical of the rest of the Democratic leadership, when she's voting for Ben Carson and Trump nominees, you know you're in a bad place if you're a Democrat. This week, people were walking. Democrats basically boycotted a series of nomination hearings for Trump nominees after massive protests from their base. And we're not talking about like the radical left here. These are not Leninists who are out in the street. These are a bunch of establishment lawyers showing up at airports saying that it's bad to ban people based on their religion. It seems like the party leaders are sort of getting the message.
So last week, unprecedented protest attendance, broadly anti-Trump, women's march, no Democrats.
That was 2 weeks ago, but yeah.
Well, you know, this is what we were talking about last week.
Few Democrats, just so we don't paint with the broadest possible brush.
Got to give Maxine Waters some credit. Right. She was at Democrats. The...
John Kerry was walking his dog by one.
His dog, yeah.
But anyway, this week, Democrats at protests. Nancy Pelosi singing, this land is your land outside the Supreme Court. Wow. Big difference.
I mean, that's great and all. I was thinking more in terms of elected Democrats going to the airport to demand that the Border Patrol honor the judicial order. But we've seen a lot more of that. We've seen,
that's an important thing here.
Yeah,
legally,
absolutely.
That was Jerry Connolly and some others.
And Jerry Connolly is not exactly a left-wing radical, right?
He's not at all.
Dyed-in-the-wool new Democrat, corporate Democrat, Clinton mold from the 1990s. He is showing up at airports saying, hey, it is bad that the judicial branch of this government has said that the Border Patrol needs to stop doing something, and the Border Patrol is doing it anyway. That is a very problematic rule of law breakdown in a democratic society. So Jerry Connolly, not exactly, a leader of the Red Army, but showing up for the rule of law.
Yeah, both Virginia Senators Tim Kaine and Mark Warner made similar appearances. I know Cory Booker was out doing the same thing, and I feel like it's been a sort of more broadly felt sentiment among Democrats watching what unfolded over the weekend happening. And, let's face it, the Democratic base, they high turnout at America's airports, which is not a place most people want to go. Of course, there's still challenges ahead. We talked last week about how there was a real need for them to start banking some resistance where they could, because we talked about how the temptation to join in with an infrastructure package is going to be pretty tempting, especially if it's a decent infrastructure package. Now, this week, Democrats come face to face with the need to confront the advise and consent on Donald Trump's new pick for the Supreme Court. And I think this is going to be kind of a real tricky pass for Democrats, because I think the base is very, very riled up about the fact that Merrick Garland, what's interesting about Merrick Garland is the base wasn't too excited about Merrick Garland when he was announced as Obama's pick.
Once again, not a leader of the Red Army.
Right. Yeah. But
old
when
white guy,
but when,
lawyer,
when Mitch McConnell basically sort of, semi-constitutionally crisised it up by sitting on that nomination, not advancing in any meaningful way, it really sort of like. The need for vindication and the expression of resentment began, and it's still very high today. The Democratic base probably just don't want anybody sitting in that seat at all. Of course, they don't have a majority. They can't guarantee that they'll block them successfully. And I'm amenable to the argument that this guy that Trump has picked, Gorsuch, may have a few interesting gifts for Democrats. But leaving that aside, what do you think Democrats should do? How should they approach this?
Well, the key benefit of Gorsuch that's been out there is that he would be potentially a check on Trump based on his past rulings in favor of judicial independence and executive overreach.
And more specifically, executive overreach in areas where immigration is the key issue.
Well, why should Democrats just roll over and let Republicans have a Supreme Court pick when this was their pick and the blockade of the previous administration's choice was totally unprecedented? Why then say, well, I guess we got to go by our traditions when the other side does not? I think that's a good question.
That's the counter argument. The Republicans didn't pay any electoral stakes for their intransigence.
Nobody cares.
There's no reason to believe that Democrats would pay any electoral stakes for being intransigent in this case. And in fact, it may energize the base a little bit much. Zach, what do you think?
Democratic Party's got to recognize that they have no policymaking power right now. What they have is the power to communicate with human beings, a majority of whom in the United States did not vote for Donald Trump, and to signal to those people that they agree with those people. They do not agree with Donald Trump. And they can try to block this Supreme Court nomination. If Mitch McConnell wants, he can just go to the nuclear option, which is increasingly a dangerous metaphor given that Donald Trump is president.
Yeah.
But they can nuke the filibuster, and then he will get through and be approved as a Supreme Court justice. There's really nothing they can do to stop Mitch McConnell from doing that. What you can do is force McConnell into a difficult spot where he's got to essentially confront and deal and negotiate with Donald Trump about whether or not he wants to do that. And then you can communicate to the rest of the public that you are not on that team. But that's all they can do. They're not going to be able to win policy battles, and they're not going to be able to do it for years. All they can do is mobilize actual human beings. And the fact that you have lawyers, people are voluntarily going to the airport right now.
Right.
Nobody in their right mind goes to an airport on the weekend when they don't have to travel. Yeah. Airports are terrible places. No one wants to be there. And you have people showing up en masse at airports all over the country to protest. Given that that energy exists, Democrats have got to figure out a way to harness that through a sort of non-federal exercise of power, which involves essentially communication and pressure on other lawmakers.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And a lot of the arguments in favor of Democrats abiding tradition and confirming or at least participating in confirmation of Supreme Court or other cabinet appointees is just like this next level chess stuff where you imagine you will call a truce with Mitch McConnell on future filibuster use, or you will store up like goodies with Trump himself that you can then call in at a later time.
Right.
When neither man has ever indicated that you really win by
When was the last time Mitch McConnell did the second most ruthless option on the table?
Right, exactly.
He always picks the first most ruthless. You're not storing up goodwill with him.
This is a pretty opportune time for Democrats. We saw the Washington Post reported yesterday that there's polling out that indicates that the Democratic base is suddenly very massively energized, especially women in the Democratic base. I remember the Los Angeles Times reporter Matt Pierce was talking about that story
and saying,
for the first time, we have actual numbers that back up what we suspected all along, which is that the Democratic base is mobilizing in a way they haven't in previous election cycles. And so it is an opportunity now for Democratic electeds to electeds tend to lag behind. They're tending to be a lagging indicator on the whole, you know, movement front. But this is a good time for them to surf that wave.
There was an interesting comment by Pelosi on basically this exact question.
51% of people between 18 and 29 no longer support the system of capitalism. But I wonder if there's anywhere you feel that the Democrats could move farther left to a more populist message, the way the alt-right has sort of captured this populist strain on the right wing. If you think we could make a more stark contrast to right-wing economics.
Well, I thank you for your question. But I have to say we're capitalist, and that's just the way it is.
So that was House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi at a town hall responding to a question from a young guy. Are Democrats going to go left the way Republicans have gone right in a populist way? And her answer was a clear no.
She said a bunch of stuff that was sort of technocratic gobbledygook that wasn't totally wrong about how capitalism has changed over the last 30 years.
Yeah, if we had let her continue talking in this clip, you would have heard all this gobbledygook about shareholders and
versus
income
stakeholders,
inequality. But the answer was no.
The answer was essentially no. And, you know, I think she's going to have a different answer the next time she's asked that question. If she's asked, can you move left on economic policy, she's not going to say, look, we're capitalists, doggone it. She's going to say, we need to do more to stand up for workers and make sure that their voices are heard in Washington. She'll say something like that the next time. But I think this is a great example of the leadership of the Democratic Party not really being prepared for this particular
And to be clear, you don't have to say we are not capitalists.
You don't have to. You don't have to start quoting Lenin here.
No,
it's okay.
Not.
That wasn't the option she was presented there.
I think she may have been dovetailing off the specific mention. Do we need an alt left to compete with an alt right?
No,
I'm of the opinion that it's not really necessary. I think
you said such toxic branding.
We don't need to bring the black bloc into this fight. And I think that's reasonable. And also, you know, 65 million people voted for Hillary Clinton, and we're not going anywhere without the people who voted for Hillary Clinton, like it or not. But to you know, you mentioned just a minute ago that the Democrats don't have the policy to make policy in the sense that they can't, you know, reliably present bills and get them enacted by Donald Trump. But to step off that for a second, you know, and I'm also kind of dovetailing with an article that Emmett Renzin recently wrote for the LA Review of Books. One of the key things about about resistance is that you have to actually have ideas on the table. You have to imagine a world to go to if you don't like the world you're in now. And so while Democrats aren't really in the position to pass a lot of bills, get a lot of laws enacted, this is still an opportune time for them to start generating ideas and start painting that picture for the people who are out there on the street about the world that they want everyone to emerge into. I feel like that can incorporate a lot of the lessons we've learned from the past election, especially a lot of the lessons about, you know, how the middle class is feeling isolated and alone with officials from the government rarely talking to them, rarely addressing their concerns, rarely even being in the space with them, and starting to sort of like merge that together with some of the policies that they've embraced for a long time that have always served them in good stead, sticking up for, you know, marginalized groups. They should understand that the middle class right now is really a marginalized group. And with Donald Trump seemingly poised to, you know, sign a national right to work bill into office.
That means national right to destroy unions.
I mean, this is the middle class is going to only grow more marginalized under Trump and eventually more angry. So 4 years from now, they can't just have a guy with a D or a woman with a D at the end of their name. They need to have a buffet of ideas, too. And they need to use their imagination now, like Emmett talked about in that piece.
I mean, look, nothing unifies a disparate group of people like a common enemy. So I think the power of no is a real thing. And there's a reason why you have a bunch of lawyers, you know, locking arms with Bernie bros at airports right now. I mean, these are people who were just fighting about the Democratic nomination for over a year, who now are on the same team. But I think the long term project here cannot disappear in the middle of that.
So where
that struggle.
If you're harnessing the power of no, where does that leave people like Sherrod Brown, who are sticking up for trade protections for low education workers? Like, does Trump just get to own that?
I mean, that is basically I think the problem. I think if Democrats do not voice a coherent, clear message about why they are the party of working people and why working people should turn to them for options, people will turn to the increasingly authoritarian tinged policies of the Trump administration.
Maybe this is a chance for a permanent 3-day weekend movement that I've always dreamed of.
What they need is a pretty simple platform with a couple of very clear principles about how they are going to be the real party.
All right, I'll see you guys on Tuesday.
Nothing's impossible. It's just hard, and you have to start doing the hard work now because it's going to take a while. All right, guys, thanks for talking us through that. We have a really fine show, and you should just stick around because we're going to be right back in a second.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. So when we left off last week, we had no idea that so many interesting things were about to happen to so many people who normally would just come back to this country from abroad. Instead, we had a pretty wild weekend of people being held up at airports and people protesting at airports. You really have to hand it to somebody when it comes to a bad political decision where you can get New Yorkers to turn out en masse at JFK Airport to protest it. That's remarkable. To discuss everything that's happened, here's Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And we welcome back Elise Foley.
Hello.
So a lot.
So exciting when I get to be here.
It is always exciting.
Bad stuff's happening.
I don't want to make it sound like every time we have a guest on, it's because bad stuff's happening. But in this case, you're back. So what happened?
Foley's Follies.
What happened, Elise? What's going on?
Okay. Well, so it's kind of complicated. Basically, the Trump administration, Trump himself, signed an order on Friday that bars people from the country if they're a refugee at all from anywhere. If they are from seven countries, just happen to be all Muslim majority countries, not a Muslim ban, guys.
Sure.
Has nothing to do with Muslims, according to the Trump people. But it targets them specifically. And that applied at first to literally anybody with a passport from those countries, including if you have a green card to be here. So like you mentioned this weekend, this past weekend, there were all these people who got held up at the airport who otherwise, I mean, who live here, who wanted to go back to their house or their kids or whatever. And they sort of had to do damage control and figure out later how what the problems were with implementing this, because they didn't even, you know all the details till it came out.
So he signs this order, and then Customs and Border Patrol has no idea how to deal with it. And it wasn't clear whether they had to detain or bar entry by green card holders.
Yeah, he signs it, and then they're like having to implement it immediately. And so they were saying, you know, they give people guidance or whatever. But if you're a person who was on a flight, you could be on a flight. You've like turned your phone on airplane mode, whatever. And then you're getting off the plane and all of a sudden you're not allowed in the country anymore.
Surprise.
I mean, and that's talking about people who are legal permanent residents. There's all sorts of people who, you know, don't have a visa that is letting them get an exception to come into the country.
The Trump administration, which is a few days old, has developed this tendency to be real shit show vaudeville about things. There's so many things about the implementation of this particular executive order that were screwy. They didn't consult with the relevant cabinet agencies. They didn't consult with lawyers to determine whether what they had actually written was legal. They invited court challenges, which they subsequently lost. It turns out that people who did consult on this executive order were legislative assistants from the House of Representatives who did so without their representatives knowing they were involved in this activity.
Weird.
It's all really a strange and fucked up way of going about this particular business.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. So the Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly was talking about this at a briefing, and he, you know, people were pressing him on whether he knew about it before it came out, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, you know, I saw drafts. You know, my staff worked on it." But there's reports that he didn't know about the details of it, at least the final order, until he was on a plane and getting briefed on it when Trump signed it. And so people were asking him, well, did you know about it in the sense, like, did you read about it in the news? Like, and he wouldn't really say, but he was saying, finally, he was like, you know, we all knew what was going to be in it because Trump has been talking about it for a year and a half on the campaign trail, which is true, but also sort of true, but also brings up what, you know, are you sure you want to say that this order is what Trump proposed to do on the campaign trail?
I think that was the most important question of the week regarding this order, because he said during the campaign he wanted to stop Muslims from coming to the United States, period.
Right.
Crystal clear.
A Muslim ban.
And not off the cuff. He wrote, you know, his campaign, wrote a statement.
And for what it's worth, we also know that he went to Rudy Giuliani for advice on how to enact a Muslim ban. We have seen Sean Spicer in repeated briefings call it a ban before he suddenly decided it wasn't a ban anymore. But there's like multiple layers of kind of like semantic disconnect going on between the wider world of reality and what the Trump administration has to say about it, including up to and including the number of people they believe were, quote, inconvenienced by this order.
Right. So they keep saying over and over, 109 people inconvenienced. And you know, the purpose of that is to make it seem like people are being hysterical about this. People, oh, people are making such a big fuss. All that happened was people were a little inconvenienced, not that many people, very small number, kind of comparing it to like when other people have to wait in line at TSA, as if there's anything similar to like
being handcuffed.
Yeah. Or, you know, station. Like locked in a room for overnight, like as a five-year-old. So anyway, the clear purpose of that is to just make it seem like the people who are upset are being excessive. In actuality, the number of people who have green cards who ended up having to go through this like special process and get a waiver to enter the country was more than 1,000, like 75 more who got other waivers. And I don't know, you know, we don't know exactly how long those people were held up, but certainly they count as being inconvenienced. And the Trump administration is, you know, conveniently does not like to mention that there's more than 109 people. Just use that number from the first 3 hours or, you know, the first few hours and use it, you know, forever. And then they can just claim that it's much smaller. And that's not even talking about the millions of people who are banned from coming to the country at all. All the refugees who are stuck in refugee camps because they're not allowed to come. So, right. I mean, even 1,000 people is far from the measure of the actual influence.
I thought given the context of Trump clearly proposing a Muslim ban that it was very valid for people to react to it the way they did, as though this were, you know, a religious test on travelers. And then these questions about the statutory origin of the countries on the list were, you know, additional detail, but an instance where nuances and details are used to distract from the big picture.
I think another thing that really disturbed me about the events of the past weekend is we mentioned that Border Patrol was kind of like left on their own to decide how to apply the instructions they got. But midway through the weekend, the ACLU won a national stay order on this law. And from there, it devolved into a lot of individual instances of Border Patrol essentially defying a court order, which is, I think, where you get into the whole constitutional crisis part.
Oh, yeah, that was disconcerting. Where, how did that shake out? How did that end up?
Well, there were so many court orders, but one of them also was that they were supposed to let people see their attorneys, and that was one that they were just not, according to the attorneys, letting people in to talk to
all week, someone. Or did they eventually relent? Like, how was that settled? It seemed like, you know, isn't there a possibility that if you defy a court order, the court has to send the U.S. Marshals to like arrest people for being in contempt of court? What
technically?
What could
yes.
have happened and what did happen?
Well, it's so hard to figure out the details of all of this because it slowed down now because people just aren't allowed to get on planes, but. For a while, I mean, there continued to be people coming in, so it's a little bit hard to say. But I believe that they've released a lot of the people who were detained. So at this point, they have been able to see their lawyers. But I mean, there were just many, many hours where that was not the case.
Can't the legislative branch resolve this impasse, however? I mean, regardless of whether they are pro Muslim ban, pro some other kind of ban, pro refugee ban, or against the whole kit and caboodle, it seems to me that it's up to them to step in and say the executive branch has to honor the court order. They have to defer to the judicial system in this case.
I mean, they could do that. I don't necessarily think that that's going to happen.
Members of Congress tried to do that, and they went and yelled at police at the airport.
And yeah. I mean, the Democrats have tried to do things. I think a lot of Republicans who voiced opposition to this, a lot of them had like broader, you know, complete opposition to the fact that this is, you know, potentially going to be used by terrorists to recruit people. But beyond that, a lot of people didn't like that it included green card holders, that it included people who were Iraqi and had worked for the U.S. Armed Forces, who some of them were got detained. And so there were criticisms about that. The Trump administration just went ahead and tried to fix those by making exceptions for those people. And I think by doing that, maybe took a little bit of the heat off of Republicans who might have been inclined to get on board with some of this and some of the restrictions. And maybe I don't know. I don't know if they'll do anything or not.
So ultimately, it looked like we dipped our toe in that constitutional crisis, but didn't fully submerge.
They still feels
stepped away from it.
It still feels very bad to me. It also
I think that we need to remember that it's not just about the people who came in this weekend and had issues. It's about all the people who never got to get on a flight to come at all, and will not.
What do you make of the reports about how Homeland Security offered an interpretation or suggestion that they not exclude legal permanent residents, green card holders, and it getting countermanded by the White House in the immediate implementation of this bill, of this executive order? It's not a bill. Sorry.
I mean, I don't. I just know the same news reports you do. I can't say I have any, you know, additional intel on it or anything. But you do have people in the White House who've been pretty critical of even legal immigration.
Right.
Stephen Miller,
Steve Bannon. Right.
And they're the people who reportedly wanted it to be as broad as it was. So I think that, you know, there is great potential that there was complete openness to having legal permanent residents on there. Unless they just were completely unaware of anything, they must have known when Trump signed the order that it would include them. The way it was written, it would include green card holders.
Finally, the next thing that's coming down the pike seems to be an executive order that would enjoin immigrants, green card holders, from public assistance.
Right. We don't know what's going to happen with that. That's one that's a draft that's out there.
Some of us here feel that might just be a trial balloon, but you never
know. Well, it's an idea people like Jeff Sessions have been kicking around for years. So clearly this stuff is all in the wings.
Yeah. All right. Well, guess what? You'll have ample opportunities to come back on the podcast, at least.
Cannot wait.
That has to thrill you, as it thrills so many of our guests. Thanks for helping us out, though. Thank you, Arthur.
You're welcome.
We will be right back. And welcome back. We're joined once again by Zach Carter.
Hey, everyone.
And also, great guest, we have our good friend, Akbar Ahmed.
Hi.
Which means we're probably going to be talking about some kind of sticky, wicky foreign entanglement that the previous administration bequeathed to the current administration against all good sense. Am I wrong?
Yeah, they could have ended it. They could have prevented some of this.
Okay, do you like the device where I show up and, like, maybe I don't know what the segment's going to be about, but I just look at the people around the table and think, oh, this must be what's happening. Now, so we're going to be talking about the ongoing conflict in Yemen. And mm-hmm. it's something that now President Donald Trump has gotten his little stubby fingers wet in. Tell us about what's been going on during the interregnum between the Obama presidency and Trump's inauguration, and where we're at now.
Sure. It's important to remember there are two conflicts in Yemen, really, that we talk about, and we shouldn't confuse them. I mean, they do relate to each other, but they are two entities. One is the counter-terror fight, however you want to say terror, but Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a big group in Yemen. It's one of the only Al-Qaeda branches ever to target the U.S. directly, one of the most lethal Al-Qaeda branches. Then there is a separate Saudi war in Yemen against Iran-backed rebels, which Obama got involved with, which means the U.S. is now involved in many sides of this war, is not quite sure what it's doing. And the Saudi war since that March of 2015 has actually given Al-Qaeda more space to grow than ever before, because everyone is focusing on fighting the Saudis and the Iranians' battles for them. And
great.
Yeah.
But this week, Donald Trump launched his first major military offensive. It was a SEAL team strike against a AQAP stronghold.
Yes.
in Yemen. I forget where in Yemen it was.
Central Yemen.
Okay, so it was in central Yemen. And it sounds to me, according to extant reports, and there are reports that maybe play up the notion of a rush to make a decision and an incompetent execution of the decision, and reports that downplay that. But it, to all reports, it sounds to me like this thing went kind of sideways.
So let's just run down the details of kind of what happened. They went into an Al-Qaeda stronghold about twice as large as they thought it was, with a lot less preparation, a lot less understanding of who was there. They killed up to 14 people, including an American 8-year-old, and one Navy SEAL was also killed in the shooting. What's important to think about here is that Trump did inherit this war from Obama, right? So the Saudis and their friends, the UAE, have been involved in Yemen now for about 2 years. The Emiratis were part of this raid. And what's really disappointing is that they were not able to provide the intelligence, the sort of strategic guidance to not end up killing this many civilians, which is scary because it also makes you think about why is the U.S. involved with these two powers if it's not even getting a counterterrorism gain out of it.
And this is... this is the side of the conflict, or the branch of conflict in Yemen, which is less problematic for a lot of people in the United States. The counterterrorism, anti-AQAP
yes.
stuff is you don't see as many people criticizing that.
No,
that,
even that, Bernie that Sanders yeah. was supportive of drone strikes in Yemen. Trump has also launched, it's important to remember, his first drone strike since he became president last weekend in Yemen. So Yemen is sort of this awful battlefield where a lot of different people can take out their anger problems, right, and sort of chalk up counter-terror wins, say we killed X number of terrorists, and obviously the classification of terrorists varies widely depending on who happens to be around.
And it's an ongoing humanitarian disaster as
Major
well.
Major humanitarian disaster, yeah. Famine, medicine sort of shortages, upwards of 10,000 people killed.
And a lot of displacement, internal displacement.
Tons of internal displacement. And we have not seen, as of yet, you know, the Trump administration is squabbling over the details of, was it a botched raid? Did we have enough intel? They have yet to give us any kind of policy or direction of what they actually want to do here to end the fighting and to stop at least this U.S.-backed, Saudi-led war. Because if that were to be stopped, that could at least allow a lot more focus on counter-terror. Doesn't help that Donald Trump has instituted a Muslim ban on countries that include Yemen. And so the Yemeni government, what remains of it, the internationally recognized Yemeni government, has always been supportive of U.S. counterterror. They've been saying, great, come drone us. Obama loves it. Bernie loves it. You all like it. Come do it. Right? But right. the more you alienate that government by saying your nationals can't even travel to our country, the
right. This is
it
even. This is even. There could be a refugee situation in short order, but this isn't even a situation
yeah.
where we're actually preventing, you know, state officials and green card holders mm-hmm. from Yemen from coming in. People who are illegal permanent residents from Yemen coming in, which is got to muddy the waters in terms of like the diplomatic mission going on between, gosh, all these parties in this area.
And it's important to remember, like, the places where we've seen terror threats to the U.S. emanate from are not places where there's just, like, big, scary, evil Muslims, like, hiding in a cave. It's places where there hasn't been civil society engagement, right? It's Afghanistan. It's northwestern Pakistan. It's places – and Yemen. Yemen is where, of course, Osama bin Laden's tribe is from. A lot of the 9/11 hijackers have Yemen ties. This is a country that, because it's been poor, ignored, and forced to live in a way that's not conducive to really, like, having a stable society – has always been a terror recruitment hub, and we're only making that worse.
Zach, am I crazy? I watched Donald Trump campaign for the better part of 2 years, and I've never really got a fix on what he thinks about military engagements. At times, he comes off like broadly as a war and intervention skeptic, the sort of person who might, if that was actually at the core of his thinking, immediately extract us from at least the civil conflict in Yemen. But at other times, he seems to embrace this notion that we're in a clash of civilizations and the best thing we can do to settle it is military deployment and bombs.
He definitely moved back and forth during the campaign from we're going to bomb the shit out of them, something he actually said on the campaign trail, to trying to claim credit for being against the Iraq War before the invasion happened, which was a lie, but was something that he repeated over and over again. So I think there are people in his base of support who have pretty serious anti-war sentiments.
They will say all the time the reason we voted for Donald Trump is it'll keep us out of wars.
Yeah,
and
yet I think there are also people in his base of support who are kind of maximalists on, yes, on foreign policy, on the ability of bombs to solve problems. I think what's particularly troubling about the Trump administration right now is the role of his advisor, Steve Bannon. I think Steve Bannon is terrifyingly bright. I think when he talks about the world and the forces at play, he talks about them in a way that's very clear and I think more cogent than what most of the Republican establishment and the Democratic Party establishment has been saying for several decades. But every time he gets to, and therefore we should do a good thing, he says, no, actually the bad people are good. His vision seems to involve a major violent global conflict being central to renewing American greatness. In this very, he talks about like the Battle of Tours and all these, mm-hmm, this weird shit from like Edward Gibbon about, you know, this clash of civilization stuff that you're talking about, where the West has got to win a war. We've got to, you know, we've got to revive Herodotus and Gibbon and conquer all the brown people. I think that's pretty scary. And he's now on. He's now a national security advisor, not just, you know, you don't usually have people who are political aides on that committee. And his worldview is one that it frightens me that the best case scenario here is that we could be sort of like a failed petro state. The worst case scenario is that we are
wiped out in a nuclear conflict.
We are instigating a world war in which we are the bad guys.
And this is where people like the Saudis and the Emiratis who are involved in Yemen should be terrified. I mean, and of course, the refrain from Muslim-majority U.S. allies has been, great, 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 he's going to hate Iran. I keep trying to remind people, this is not an Iranophobic administration. That's a classic Republican view. This is an Islamophobic administration, which is very different. That's going to target your allies. It's going to target Saudi, Turkey, all of them. And hopefully, they sort of will shape up and not give them more cause to target them. But I can certainly see a wrench being pushed. And the Yemen war is a perfect wrench. Ramp up Saudi conflict, make them commit war crimes, and then say, well, actually, now we hate you, so here's the war.
And that's a very different sort of place for the foreign policy debate, yes, to be than where it was 6 months ago when you had people like Chris Murphy, as you know, a mainstream Democratic senator, not, mm-hmm, like a left winger or anything, saying, you know, we need to rethink the United States relationship.
In a quite nuanced way. Yeah, right. that's not that.
I mean, Bannon has also indicated that he thinks we're going to be going to war with China within 5 to 10 years, which, if Donald Trump got reelected, would put squarely in his administration. I have a hard time contemplating a war with China because I think about, well, I mean, it would be in the South China Sea probably. We'd have to, like, eliminate the Navy they have there. To do that, we'd have to mount a conventional attack on the Chinese mainland. And I don't know if a conventional attack on the Chinese mainland triggers anything other than a nuclear response.
There are real problems with the United States foreign policy with respect to China. There have been decisions made over the last 30 years that I think have been the United States just doesn't really know what to do. You know, the trade policy in particular, where supply chains for everything from like matches to light bulbs is controlled, has to go through China. So, you know, we if we start a violent conflict with China, there's all sorts of just stuff that we can't have in the United States.
Yes.
So there are
fire and light.
and there are problems with the U.S. foreign policy approach to China. The right response to that is to fix them, not to start chest thumping about going to war with a country of a billion people.
And to maintain right U.S. relationships. Because the other thing about it's tempting to see this all as inevitable, right? That Bannon and Trump can get us what they want by pushing us to a situation where a terror attack happens, where the U.S. can turn on, you know, and a big conflict is just inevitable because of their policies. It's important to remember they can't accomplish what they see as important without the U.S.'s network of power. The U.S.'s power is Britain and Australia. It is Europe, right? And if Australia wants to be chummier with China, which it could well be. They've already been making moves towards that over the last 3 months. Trump insulted them last weekend. If Europe is floating away and again getting closer to China, they loved Xi Jinping when he showed up at Davos in January. The U.S. isn't going to have the capacity, and so instead it's going to become this kind of small, isolated place where a matchbox costs $15.
That is not how you expand global influence.
That's it's also not particularly populist, but what can I say?
Look, I mean, the thing that's really bad about this is that there is a totally credible case for a for the United States to be taking a tougher line with China on the international stage. To some extent, I think Barack Obama was trying to do that with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't think that was a particularly well thought out way of going about that. But there is a reasoned, rational case for taking a measured, more harder line with China. Going around talking about going to war with people is not a reasoned, measured approach.
And offering your softer face. I was at the Chinese embassy on Wednesday at the Chinese National Day, and lo and behold, at 7:45 p.m., literally Ivanka Trump starts walking towards my face. She's also like gargantuan. She's like 8 feet tall. But you know, she arrived at this Chinese embassy, and she was obviously meant to be this goodwill ambassador. It doesn't matter if you have Ivanka saying, we like the world, and I will come to the Chinese embassy and look at your dumpling display, right? Like, which is literally what she did yesterday. If, on the other hand, you're saber-rattling every minute. And so that's the question, who wins out in the Trump clicks?
This is bad. This is very bad.
Don't worry, John McCain and Lindsey Graham will figure it out.
Yeah, what world are we living in where John McCain and Lindsey Graham are the cautious, reasonable foreign policy intelligentsia from the Republican Party?
We're living in this world, apparently.
Indeed.
All right, Zach and Akbar. Zach Barr. Thank you for being with us, and we will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Elise Foley. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Please check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next week if we're all alive.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.